Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, but before I name them, an embarrassing disclosure. There were supposed to be three, but my fancy little new recording device ate the interview, so we're down to two, which means you'll be hearing more from me than usual. Okay, now the names. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Ben Jacobs, a reporter with Newsweek and the Daily Beast, on the upcoming recall vote in Wisconsin. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the great federal budget pundit Stan Collender on the so-called fiscal cliff that awaits us at year-end, the combination of spending cuts and tax increases that would almost certainly drive us back into recession unless Congress acts to stop it. Before that, some words in the news. I'll get to the Mayer Employment Report in a moment, but first I wanted to say something about the Chris Hayes controversy from Memorial Day weekend. On his MSNBC show on the Sunday of that weekend, Hayes filed some objections to the use of the word heroes to refer to our soldiers, saying, among other things, that the designation was a way to sell unpopular wars. For this, he was fried by the usual idiots, which is to be expected. But then in a disappointing move on Monday, Hayes, a very decent fellow, walked it back, as they say in D.C., basically apologizing for having told the truth. Hayes told me that no one asked him to do this. But this is one of those things that you don't have to be asked to do. It's how hegemony works. If you want to keep your TV show, you can't be seen as criticizing the military in any way. Several times over the years, I've had the wonderful feminist scholar Cynthia Enloe on this show to talk about the military, one of her major topics of interest. I tried to get her on this week, but couldn't get hold of her. So I'll do the next best thing and channel her. There is no other country that calls itself a democracy, Israel excepted, that has so militarized daily life. There's also no other putative democracy that has so many infrequent compulsory rituals of patriotism. Why do we sing the national anthem at sporting events? Why are we expected to pledge allegiance to the flag? There is no other democracy that has a pledge of allegiance like this. I'm very sad that Chris Hayes felt like he had to apologize, but this isn't really about him. It's about our curious notions of freedom, which require constant genuflection to flag, army, and church. With this kind of ingrained deference, who needs fascism? And now on to the May U.S. Employment Report. It was another saggy one, and revisions to the previous 2 months' data made the recent history even saggier than we initially thought. For a while, it looked like some weather mischief might be distorting the figures. Activity normally undertaken in spring could have been brought forward into the unusually warm January and February, which came in stronger than anticipated. But that interpretation no longer looks supportable. There's a real slowdown underway, and the question is now whether we've reached the dangerous stage of stall speed, on which more in a few minutes. Employers added just 69,000 to their payrolls in May, less than a third the long-term monthly average. That's the lowest gain in a year. The average gain for the last 3 months is under 100,000, compared with 250,000 for the previous 3 months. Just three sectors, transportation and warehousing, healthcare and wholesale trade, together accounted for more than the entire private sector gain, since so many other sectors were either flat or down. Manufacturing was up decently, but construction was down hard, and the once strong leisure and hospitality sector was also off. Government employment continued its long decline, a real anomaly for a recovery period by historical standards. For all the moaning by the right, government spending and employment has been a drag on recovery, not the usual stimulus. If getting government out of the way were really the route to economic health, we'd be bounding about now instead of scraping along the bottom. The length of the average work week fell, and average hourly earnings were barely changed. As a result, the total number of hours worked throughout the entire economy fell, as did the total earnings of the broad working class. Both are unusual occurrences in a recovery. It's impossible to sustain an economy on trends like these over the longer term. The figures I've been quoting come from a survey of 300,000 employers. The simultaneous survey of about 60,000 households looked somewhat better, but not all that much. The share of the adult population working rose by 0.2 percentage point, but that only reversed the decline of the previous 2 months. And while the household measure of employment showed good gains, they were more than entirely accounted for by gains in part-time employment, much of it among people who prefer a full-time work. The number of full-time workers fell by over 250,000. The unemployment rate rose 0.1 point, as an uncommonly large number of people entered a workforce that was unable to accommodate them fully. But the problem of long-term unemployment, which had gotten a little better for a few months, got worse again in May. The average unemployed person has been out of work for nearly 40 weeks, one of the longest spells on record, and this is almost 3 years into an economic recovery. While this report hardly qualifies as a disaster, it does confirm that there's a real slowdown underway and not just some weather-related quirks. The question now is this just a return to the post-financial crisis norm of weak gains, or a stall-speed transition to something worse? There's good historical evidence that the U.S. economy just can't live with slow growth. And yes, before anyone emails me, I know that growth is not ecologically sound, but until we undertake some serious structural reforms, it's the only game in town. So if growth gets much slower than it is now, we're quite likely to fall back into recession. Add the worsening euro troubles, and it's looking to me like the Federal Reserve will begin dusting off the extraordinary measures playbook very soon, because God knows that neither the President nor Congress will do anything of the sort. Okay, now I'm going to do something I rarely do, namely read something of my own at some length. Excerpts from a talk I gave at LaGuardia Community College in Queens, New York on May 21st, in memory of my old friend Bob Fitch, who died in March of last year. Bob was a scholar, union organizer, journalist, and all-around excellent human being, who, by the way, spent the 1960s in Berkeley as a student and later as an editor at Ramparts before heading east in the 1970s. This is about 40% of what I said. You can find the full text on my blog at lbo-news.com. lbo-news.com. I met Bob in the late 1980s. I can't remember exactly when. He was just resurfacing after several years underground. A major publisher had given him a big advance to write a book about New York City, and he found it impossible to deliver. Bob delisted his phone number, gave up writing for union organizing, and tried to keep the forces of the bourgeois system at bay. When the coast cleared, he started writing for the Village Voice. His editor there, and mine, Don Guttenplan, introduced me to him. On Don's recommendation, I just read Bob's fantastic 1976 essay, Planning New York, which is adapted for his book, The Assassination of New York, 20 years later. It was about the 1929 plan for New York City drawn up by the Regional Plan Association. It laid out the outline for an auto-centered metropolitan region, including the highway system that would later be attributed to Robert Moses. It developed and formalized an old upper-class desire to deindustrialize the urban center. The essay made it impressively clear just how precisely planned by elites over the very long term the physical and social evolution of New York City has been. One's casual impression of the city may be that it's unplanned and chaotic, but it's long been anything but that. It's been guided by the careful hand of the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate, and the elite nonprofits and experts that think for it. Bob and I became good friends after I read the essay. We saw each other from time to time, but a lot of our friendship was on the phone, many hours a week. Bob talked to me a lot about the ideas that led to the assassination of New York. I'd been living in the city for about 10 years when I met him, and until then I'd never really understood how the place works. I'd only the vaguest idea of how people like Felix Roten and firms like his Lazard Frere shaped the city. I'm not really up to analyzing the present from the perspective of Bob Fitch, but I would like to talk about some of the things he shaped my thinking on. At least three come to mind. One is New York City, now ruled by a true plutocrat, though it's not like Bill Thompson or Christine Quinn or any other likely mayoral hopefuls would be much different. Another is the state of the labor movement. When I was first asked for a title for this talk, I thought of something like The Labor Movement Survived Bob Fitch, but barely. The spectacle of Trumka's AFL-CIO endorsing Obama months before they really had to reminded you that institutions like economic stats can come in under expectations, even when your expectations are already low. Back in 1995, when many in the labor left were excited over the ascension of John Sweeney to the leadership of the AFL-CIO, Bob dismissed it as delusional. He was right, but not many people wanted to hear it at the time. And then there are the Democrats, in whom organized labor is incorporated in a vassal-like relation. Though a lot of liberals moaned some about Obama last year, this year re-electing him is a task of world historical proportions. Personally, I'd like to see Obama re-elected because it's better for radicals when Dems are in power. it makes it clear how the suckiness is systemic and not a matter of personnel or party. But this is not the prevailing view. The urgency to support the Democrats, as it often is driven by the awfulness of the right. If Romney wins, the Tea Party will move into the executive office building, and so can the brown shirts be far behind. I recently came across the text of a talk that Bob gave to the Harlem Tenants Council 10 days after Obama was elected. After acknowledging Obama's considerable talents and powers of enchantment and the pride that African Americans felt over his election, Bob wondered just what his political philosophy was and what interest did he represent. His political philosophy, said Bob, was third wayish and communitarian, meaning that he dismissed any idea that there are real conflicts in society because we can all just reason together and do what's best for all of us. But by saying that, they're really just siding with the powers that be because there are real conflicts in society and there could be no best for everyone happy ending. Following that intro is a dazzling analysis of Obama's roots in Chicago society, one of those Fitchian moments in which the world makes a lot more sense after you've gone through it. Many of us are familiar with the way that Obama was groomed for excellence by power from his early days. Beloved of elite schools and foundations from his youth, Obama, who's poked fun at his mother's position paper liberalism, had a charmed rise in the status ladder of American society. When he arrived in the Senate, after not all that much experience in the Illinois legislature, he would have none of the glad-handing necessary to get along that dismal body. So Harry Reid called him in after about a year and a half and told him that he had no aptitude for the Senate, so he should run for president instead. Reid and company were terrified that Hillary Clinton would get the nomination and lose disastrously, so Obama was their hope. Yet they were so afraid of Hillary's vengefulness that they promoted his candidacy secretly at first. Obama proved himself up to that challenge. But that this guy was any kind of outsider, that he was anything but wired to the center of the Democratic branch of the power structure, well, it was remarkable what people believed in 2007-2008. But Bob's great contribution was to trace Obama's roots in Chicago property relations. Over the last 2 decades, he reported, there's been a concerted plan to gentrify the south side of that city, home to the largest black population in the country, many of them rather poor. Among the country's 10 biggest cities, Chicago has the third highest poverty rate and the highest black poverty rate. In the 1950s, the preferred policy was urban renewal, meaning raising low-rise housing and moving black Chicagoans en masse into high-rise public housing. It did not work well. So in the 1990s, Democratic urban planners decided it was time to spatially deconcentrate, meaning knock down the high-rises and move people back into dispersed private housing. This was touted as an anti-poverty measure. Since poverty is considered by these experts to be a communicable disease, scattering the poor about town will reduce their exposure to each other, thereby reducing the spread of the illness. In Chicago, Daley's administration cleverly brought black developers into the heart of the scheme. They would build and rehab the new units the displaced poor would move into. Since much of this had happened in Obama's state Senate district, he knew the principal players very well. As Bob put it, there was a constellation of interests around Obama in Chicago. The typical fire sector, personified by big Chicago families like the Pritzkers and the Crowns, but also by what Bob called friendly fire, the liberal foundations and nonprofit developers who try to synthesize an aura of community uplift around gentrification. A lot of what's called community organizing in this country quickly devolves into high-minded real estate development, typically with the assistance of the Ford Foundation, which by a not very stunning coincidence employed Obama's mother in Indonesia. And although almost all of the people displaced by friendly fire are poor and black, they're often displaced by a black financier developer class that serves a rising black middle class. For the portion of the left that trades on one-dimensional race analysis of social life, this is all very confusing. But this is how Obama, the community organizer, could, just a few years later, praise Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan and Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs as savvy businessmen. And so it was hardly surprising that Obama brought in William Daley, brother of former Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, by virtue of office the chief executive of the Southside gentrification schemes, to be his chief of staff after Rahm Emanuel went off to become mayor of Chicago. Oh, and it just happened that William Daley was also the head of Midwest operations for J.P. Morgan Chase and chair of their foundation, which Bob called the core of friendly fire. It doesn't take anything away from Bob's genius to say that these are not the kinds of facts you need to spend years in obscure archives or filing a ream of Freedom of Information requests to discover. He did lots of that over the years, too, but not for this talk. Most of the secrets of American life are, like Poe's purloined letter, hidden in plain sight. It's just that many people don't want to think about them. Certainly not all those people suffering from Obamamania in 2008 when Bob gave that talk, or even the mildly disillusioned liberals of 2010, and certainly not all those born-again enthusiasts suffering from a relapse of their 2008 enchantment in 2012. Years divisible by four produce such predictable delusions. There follows, in the original text, a long analysis of Bob's work in the planning of New York by the fire elite that is probably of limited interest to non-residents. Let it just be said that that elite drove manufacturing and the port out of town to make the city safe for office buildings. They started in this scheming back in the early 20th century, and it continues to today. No doubt similar things can be said for San Francisco, Chicago, and other high-end cities in the U.S. I don't know the details. I'm also skipping most of my discussions of Bob's work on organized labor, which he criticizes pathologically structured and as almost feudal entities, in which out-of-touch and overpaid leaders collect dues from passive members and offer them little in return, and even less to the broader working class. And now back to the prepared text. Bob's relentless criticisms of the labor movement for being made up of corrupt and ossified feudal structures made him very few friends. He went too far for even some of the left wing of the labor movement who just don't want to hear what he had to say. He might be okay to criticize labor for having lost its fighting spirit to bureaucratization, but as Bob liked to say, it's wrong to call the labor movement bureaucratic because bureaucracies are effective. The rot was deeper and much more structural. Alexander Coburn once said that the mission of the bourgeois pundit is to fire volley after volley of cliché into the densely packed prejudices of his readers. Left media often do the same. Bob would have none of this. Though he had an excellent circle of passionately devoted friends and fans, he alienated a lot of the people who could have made his life materially easier. I have a 6-year-old son who gets upset when people believe in fictions. He's not against fiction as fiction. His problem arises when people actually believe stories of their own creation. He wouldn't agree with Wallace Stevens that the final belief is to believe in a fiction, which you know to be a fiction, there being nothing else. So when kids talk about the tooth fairy, my son indignantly tells them there's no such thing. The same with Santa Claus. He seems pretty sound on the God question, too. I think he might have inherited this from me. I want to tell him that it won't make you popular, but I stop myself, because we need all the people like that we can get. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Wisconsin. That was some of Margin Walker by Fugazi, a title. Shares part of its name with Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who faces a very unusual recall election next Tuesday. I happened to be in Madison just by accident in February 2011, when the crowds first took over the state capitol and launched a rebellion against his move to strip public employee unions of their collective bargaining rights. 15 months ago, when it first started, it felt like a powerful movement. But now it's looking like Walker will survive the recall. Intrade, the betting website, is offering 95% odds in favor of Walker winning. What happened? For one, I'd say that the unions never succeeded in convincing the broad public that Walker's attack on them was an attack on the entire working class. As any student of Bob Fitch knows, this is a perpetual problem of American unions, which all too often look like they're more concerned with their own interests than those of the broad population. And they look like that because it's all too often true. For more on the Wisconsin situation, here's Ben Jacobs, a reporter with Newsweek and the Daily Beast, who's been covering the story for both outlets. Ben Jacobs. Welcome, Ben. We've got the Wisconsin recall election coming up. How's it looking now?
Right now, Scott Walker, the incumbent Republican governor, is favored, but it's still close. If there's been a battle of dueling polls, that Democratic operatives have been touting one set of polls that show a dead heat, and the Walker campaign has been trying to say that they have a lead that's about 5 or 6 points, and it's a little bit unclear in terms of where things are going to end up. But right now, Walker would have to have the slight edge a week out, but it's still close enough that anything could happen.
And InTrade has Walker at 93. Last I looked, that's a little too certain for your taste?
That's a little too certain for my taste. I'd put his chances at closer to two-thirds, maybe, that this is a recall election. There's no real precedent for this, and also dealing with a situation where the Democrats have a far superior turnout machine, that Walker's big strength has been coming from, you know, his out-of-state money has been coming from billionaires, which is, you know, certainly helpful for running TV ads, but when it comes time to get out the vote, you know, the Democrats' out-of-state money is coming from labor unions, which have feet on the ground, that they're, you know, people working in Wisconsin who are very upset with Walker in terms of public employees, teachers, and that they'll have that many more bodies on the ground, which could make a difference in an election that has all sorts of possibilities for what the turnout could be.
The funding gap is enormous, though, isn't it?
Yes. It's somewhat closer than it looks that right now the latest campaign finance reports, or at least there was a new round that came up, but, you know, their campaign finance reports at the beginning of May that had Walker having almost $30 million raised and Barrett less than a million, which is sort of narrowed down when you take into account labor money and also the fact that Barrett only jumped in late March, whereas Walker had been able to raise money and take advantage of a loophole in campaign finance for, you know, 6 to 8 months before.
And when you say the Democrats have to get out the vote machine, I assume that's the unions working phones and knocking on doors?
Yes.
I know, who is Barrett? He's for an out-of-stater, he's a pretty obscure figure.
Yes, he's the current mayor of Milwaukee. He ran against Walker in 2010 and lost by about 5 or 6 points in a very tough Democratic year. He'd been a congressman, but sort of lost his seat in redistricting, and after being squeezed out, ran for mayor of Milwaukee in 2004 and has been serving as mayor of Milwaukee since.
And some of the more celebrity politicians have shied away from the run?
Yes, particularly on the Democratic side, that President Obama hasn't, you know, been active there, nor has Vice President Biden, or a lot of national figures.
Well, no, I meant that people like Russ Feingold didn't want to run against Walker.
Excuse me. No, Russ Feingold didn't want to run. Herb Kohl didn't want to run. David Obey didn't want to run. On that, Barrett jumped in late because the leader of the Democratic field, the former county executive where Madison is, was considered a rather lackluster candidate.
But the was he the one that the unions favored?
Yes, she was the one, Kathleen Falk. And Barrett came in at the last minute and ended up beating her relatively handily in the primary.
And now the National Democrats have really kind of shied away from this campaign. It seemed, you know, a year ago, it seemed like this was pretty hot stuff, and now they don't want to touch it. What's up?
It's a number of factors. I think there's a risk-reward factor that, in terms of staking political capital on a race that, in a swing state that you might not win, that there's been some movement recently. Martin O'Malley is going to be out in Wisconsin over the next few days. Debbie Wasserman Schultz held a fundraiser for Barrett from the DNC finally in the past on Tuesday. But it, you know, they don't seem to want to be invested in it. It's sort of a little bit difficult to figure out why. I think it's just a matter of what the risk-reward is in November.
Well, now, if they had thrown more resources or more personalities or, you know, into it, then would the outcome be looking so favorable to Walker?
Probably not. That, you know, according to the latest poll that from Marquette, which the Barrett campaign, excuse me, is disputing its accuracy, which has Walker up 6 or 7 points, it has Obama up 8 points. That, you know, that big swing that in terms of the difference he could make in terms of getting out the vote, particularly there's a large African-American community in Milwaukee, as well as in terms of money and sort of trying to balance out the resource gap a little bit.
How much of this is around Walker's record? I mean, has he had anything like an economic record to run on?
he's been disputing his economic record, that this has shifted initially from a labor focus to job creation. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with data that showed Wisconsin had the worst job creation record in the nation over the past year, and Walker came out with his own data which stated otherwise. And a lot of the campaign has been Walker and Barrett going back and forth about numbers, which is not terribly exciting or interesting to voters.
It may not be terribly exciting or interesting, but how could Walker have better numbers than the Bureau of Labor Statistics?
Through a program that the state of Wisconsin does in terms of mandating employers to report numbers, which includes, in his figures, 97% of the state's employers, but which only covers two-thirds of the state's workforce. It's a very sort of strange game in terms of playing around with the numbers, and the numbers aren't terribly great anyway. He just wants to at least say positive gains in numbers, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics has Wisconsin losing jobs.
And he doesn't want to be worst. Are there other issues besides the collective bargaining stuff that are being discussed in the campaign?
Yes. Another issue that's been raised repeatedly by Democrats in the past few weeks is what's called the John Doe investigation. Walker, when he was the county executive of Milwaukee County, which includes not just the city but the very Republican suburbs around, had an office that was involved in corruption scandals, that there's issues with former aides embezzling money from veterans and taking it on a trip to Hawaii. And that's become a big issue. None of it's tied to Walker personally yet. They're trying hard to leak him, and the investigation is sealed, but Walker has set up a legal defense fund. And the issue with that is, if there's any dirt on Walker that will come out, it's not going to come out between now and Tuesday.
How are these guys as candidates? Are they scintillating personalities or not?
Not in the least bit. Barrett is sort of a pleasant, boring man. Walker has sort of, you know, to the people who quite like him, you know, is sort of inspiring. He's taking the fight to the unions, you know, trying to approach things from a relatively neutral perspective. Walker kind of comes across as, you know, one of Nixon's henchmen and all the president's men. He just kind of comes across as sort of menacing dweeb.
That's a very pleasant combination. How much has the collective bargaining issue resonated with the broad population, or is this really a kind of narrow issue of concern, mostly the union members?
It's resonated, but at this point, it's a little bit baked in the cake that there, you know, that this was such a big fight, you know, last year, that when you had 100,000 people taking over the Capitol 15 months ago, that at this point, it's been very much litigated out, and people have very strong feelings about it. And at this point, you know, most of those folks have their minds firmly made up anyway, so the campaign isn't focusing on that because there are no voters to win at this point on collective bargaining.
And what about the relative enthusiasm of the two parties?
Right now, there's very high level of Republican enthusiasm. There's a slightly lower level of enthusiasm for Democrats, but you know, it's still up in the air that, you know, if you look at opinion polls, that normally there's a spread that, you know, 10% of voters strongly like, 20% somewhat like, 30% don't have an opinion, and sort of an arc, a bell curve. At this point, it's all clustered. Everyone about Walker either strongly likes or strongly dislikes. That this is an election over, you know, about turnout in a very tiny sliver of swing voters, if there are any voters who haven't made up their minds yet in Wisconsin.
And there's not a whole lot of passion on the Democratic side.
There is a lot of passion, but it's anti-Walker passion. The passion, Barrett is not an exciting standard bearer. Falk, the other Democratic candidate, wasn't. That it's all, the issue is entirely Barrett. That it, in some ways, is like the dynamics around the 2004 election, where you had Republicans very devoted to George W. Bush and Democrats deeply opposed to George W. Bush, not so much excited about John Kerry, but just stirred by anti-Bush fervor.
Now, I just happened to be in Madison when this all started. I had a long time, a scheduled engagement there, and it felt extraordinarily exciting at the moment and in the weeks just afterwards. But now that moment of upsurge and resistance, does this have any national significance anymore, or has it just become pretty much a Wisconsin issue?
I think it certainly has national significance, that this is a big test, not just is a run-up to the presidential election as trial heat before November in a swing state. But in terms of efforts to deal with labor in the future, the American labor movement, that labor is very deeply invested in this, and trying to send a message that there's certain anti-labor restrictions that you can put on them, that they had big successes in Ohio with a referendum last year when John Kasich tried to do something relatively similar. And if they can succeed in Wisconsin, then it sort of puts labor back in the driver's seat in a way it hasn't been for a relatively long time in the United States.
So should we draw any national conclusions from this election? Or will there be tea leaves for the presidential campaign?
There will be some tea leaves in terms of turnout. This is a somewhat different election, but this is still a highly competitive, highly partisan election happening in a swing state a few months before November. And that in terms of turnout, in terms of excitement, that's going to be very important to figure. And also in terms of the momentum, that Scott Walker, if he wins, will have a lot of momentum and sort of really get Republicans juiced up for the coming months. And vice versa, if the Democrats win, it's a real blow against Republicans and a real blow for organized labor, which will excite them as well.
That was Ben Jacobs, a reporter with Newsweek and The Daily Beast. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after their musical break to discuss fiscal follies. That was one of the 15 Hungarian peasant songs by Béla Bartók, performed by Jéno Jandó. My next guest is Stan Collender, a veteran D.C. budget watcher. He is a partner at Corvus Communications, that's spelled with a Q, a columnist for Roll Call, and his blog can be found at capitalgainsandgames.com. Stan Collender. Welcome, Stan Collender. First, the fiscal cliff that is awaiting us come year end, describe its nature and dimensions.
This is the fiscal or budget or economic version of the harmonic convergence. That is a whole bunch of federal policies that are inadvertently or intentionally all coming together at the same time. It includes the expiration of the Bush and Obama tax cuts, the expiration of the payroll tax cut, probably funding for the federal government as a whole. In other words, the government would shut down unless the legislation is passed during this time. The doc fix, that is the provision that would cut Medicare payments to doctors by 27%, will if it's not extended, expires then. The debt ceiling and the AMT relief for the current fiscal year all has to be done by December 31st at midnight. Otherwise, the government and the economy turns into a pumpkin. And if that wasn't enough, on January 2nd, you have this big spending cut going to be triggered and take place. This is the spending cut that is happening because the Anything But Super Committee failed to come up with a deficit reduction plan back November. So the government, the economy is behind the eight ball because of all these things coming together at the same time.
Now, what exactly is the nature of these automatic spending cuts? What would be cut?
It's half from defense and half from non-defense. So it's about $50 or $60 billion from each side. And it's supposed to be, although we don't know exactly, literally across the board. That is, the last time we had a cut like this, it was during the Graham-Rudman-Hollings era in the 80s, and it was by program, project, and activity. So there was no discretion. But right now, the president may have a little more discretion. We're not sure. The White House isn't telling anybody. But it's these are all appropriations. It doesn't have anything to do with Medicare or Medicaid or any of the other so-called entitlement programs. Interest on the debt can't be cut, so it would be $60 billion from the or so from the defense establishment, $60 billion from every total from all government agencies. So there probably isn't any program that wouldn't be affected in some form.
Now, this was concocted because, one, Congress couldn't actually come up with anything that was more specific than that, but also because it was supposed to be so unpalatable to all concerned that they would be forced to do something. Is that the idea behind this?
Well, the sequester, there's one automatic across-the-board cut, that's absolutely right. We all thought that members of Congress would do anything possible, or members of Congress thought themselves would do anything possible to avoid these kind of automatic look, mono, hands theory of budgeting kind of cuts going into place. Turns out you can't embarrass members of Congress that much. That is, you put these things in place and some of them just shrug their shoulders and say, oh, what the hell, let's just cut spending. This way we don't have to raise taxes. And that's the big rub here. That's the political thing. There are some members of Congress, the Tea Party folks in particular, for whom raising taxes for any reason, raising revenues for any reason, is absolutely the worst possible thing, both politically, economically, morally, whatever, any other way you want to talk about it. So they would rather see spending cut, even if it means the Defense Department, than allow those tax cuts to go into place. So when the Anything But Super Committee failed, the worst case scenario actually came true, and that is, you know, these spending cuts are being triggered, and now it will take legislation to stop them.
And of course, this is supposed to happen again in the future.
It's not just a 2013 phenomenon. This is supposed to happen every year for 10 years, all the way through fiscal 2021. Now, it's done a little differently in future years, but it's the same effect. That is, overall, spending would be cut by $1.2 trillion, half from defense and half from non-defense. And there are several big fights going on now. One, every time you hear Ben Bernanke or anybody else talk about the fiscal cliff, they're saying that these spending cuts, along with the tax increases that might happen, would seriously harm the economy because they would be too much too quickly and the economy is not in great shape to handle it. But the other big fight going on is that let's let these spending cuts go in place, but let's exempt defense from it. Let's take $120 billion just from the domestic side. Now, there's only about $500 billion in domestic spending. So the idea that they take $120 billion out of $500, $600 billion is crazy. So that's not going to happen. But it just means that this is going to be a perils of Pauline cliffhanger ending come the end of the year.
Now, let's review how we got to this situation. First of all, if you listen to a lot of Republican rhetoric, Obama is a reckless taxer. But in fact, the revenue share of GDP is the lowest it's been in quite a long time, isn't it?
I think probably, you know, what is it where they're talking about now, revenue being as a percent of GDP, about 15%, maybe even a little below that at some point. That compares to a historical average of between 18 and 19%. You know, so it's to say that it's nonsensical and to say that it's not based in substance would be using a polite term for what it really is, which is spin and BS on that particular thing. And there's also now evidence that that Obama's not the big spender that Republicans say he is. You know, that a lot of the spending that's taken place was in some cases triggered back in the 1930s when Social Security was put in place, or in the 1960s when Medicare and Medicaid were put in place. And interest on the debt, of course, is a result of debt that's been borrowed, money that's been borrowed for the last 30 years or so, if not longer. The truth is that in part because of political stalemate, in part because it's not Obama's nature, other than the stimulus, there hasn't really been a lot of additional money being spent. And even the stimulus wasn't all spending. It was some tax cuts in there as well.
And the reason that revenue is so low, how much is policy and how much is the weak economy?
A little bit of both. We've obviously had a number of tax cuts. As I said, the stimulus included about 40% of the stimulus that was passed in 2009 was a tax cut. You then had extension of the Bush tax cuts, now the Bush-Obama tax cuts, and a cut in the payroll tax. As far as I know, there's been no tax increases over that period. Discussions about it, but nothing legislated that would increase revenues compared to what they would have been under current law. Add to that the fact that the denominator is changing. That is, the GDP growth is obviously not been substantial, and in some cases, GDP has actually fallen. And you get a kind of witch's brew of things that have reduced revenues as a percent of GDP.
And then on the spending side, there's been some information circulating recently showing that, federal spending, it's a little hard to calculate this exactly, but federal spending has actually been growing quite slowly under Obama compared to his predecessors. Then if you throw in state and local spending, I mean, we're really, the growth in government spending is just very, very weak, right?
Well, and that's exactly right. I mean, when you take a look at the major components of GDP, you've got consumers not spending. Unless it's an Apple product that's coming out on the market for the first time. You've got state and local governments cutting back, not increasing. And you've got businesses hoarding cash. Private businesses are holding more cash than at any time in American history. So the only element of GDP, the only factor within the GDP equation that's actually been adding to economic growth has been the federal government, and even that's been slowing down because the politics have made this impossible for the president to request anything additional, and Congress wouldn't approve it even if they thought it was a good idea. It's one of the reasons fiscal policy has been such a poor tool during this economic slowdown. Add to that the fact that we're winding down activities in Iraq and Afghanistan, and even the military is not adding to economic growth in the way it has in the past. So, I mean, all the major components of GDP right now are slow, and it's being reflected in overall economic growth. And you know, we should probably talk about the fact that that's at least as politically motivated as anything else.
What do you mean by that?
There was a lot of discussion about how big the stimulus should have been in 2009. Some, like Paul Krugman and others, were discussing that it needed to be, just on a numerical basis, the fiscal gap was about $1.4 trillion. They ended up with about $700 billion, actually $787, but $80 billion of that or so was just extending the AMT relief, and that didn't provide any additional stimulus anyway. So it was $700 billion, or half what it needed to be, and since then, there's been no ability for political reasons, with Republicans trying to deny Obama any kind of improvement in the economy. There's been no ability to do anything additional on the stimulus side. In the meantime, there's been a lot of pressure on the Federal Reserve not to do a QE3 or any additional monetary stimulus because, again, there's been a movement to keep the economic growth slow, keep job growth slow, so that Obama's approval numbers go down. There's pretty good evidence that that's working.
Yeah, we just got the employment report this morning, rather disappointing, the previous month revised down. So we're seeing a significant slowdown, no doubt about it.
With no ability, no willingness of Congress to address the correct fiscal policy. I mean, what's being talked about is a version of austerity in this country that would make Herbert Hoover smile.
Or Angela Merkel, who knows.
Yeah.
Now, is this pure partisan obstructionism, or is there a philosophy of government behind it?
I don't think there's any doubt that the philosophy of government that Republicans are espousing, smaller governments, less spending has to be cut, is stated in almost religiously certain terms, is really a justification after the fact for what is a power play. They see denying Obama, denying the Democrats a good economy, as a path to power, as a path to taking over the Senate, as a path to retaining the House, and as a path to a Republican candidate winning the White House. It is cynical governing at best. In fact, it's not governing at all. It's election campaigning. It's electioneering. It's campaigning perpetually. And while there are some probably true believers in smaller government, I would think a Ron Paul, for example, falls into that category. That's not typical of what you hear and see inside Washington. Instead, all the indications are that this is an explicit plan by congressional Republicans in particular to bring the economy down, to bring down the Obama presidency so that they can get into office come election day.
Is there any precedent for this?
Not that I can see, at least certainly not in my lifetime, and I've been watching this. I've been a budget analyst watching, you know, fiscal policy for almost 40 years. I've never seen a lack of governing. In fact, when I first came to Washington, the situation was actually very, very different. You had Republicans working with Democrats to get things done. They would fight like hell in committee, but once they agreed on a deal, they would work to make it happen. Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann's book, It's Worse Than It Looks, that just came out and hit the bestseller list almost immediately, shows that this is a relatively unprecedented situation. The use of a filibuster in the Senate, even when there's almost unanimous consent on the ultimate policy designed to slow things down, the lack of willingness to govern, I've never seen anything quite like this. Now, to be honest, I think it stems back to the impeachment of Richard Nixon. That was the beginning of the end of a polite governing in Washington. But you've now got a situation where, and I've seen this happen personally, Republicans, if you're in a House or Senate office building, Republicans won't get on the elevator with Democrats and vice versa, staff and members. And when I worked on Capitol Hill, you know, my boss, who was an extreme liberal, would have lunch once a week with an extreme right-wing member of the Republican Party because they enjoyed each other's company. You would never, ever see that today.
What is behind this? I mean, is there some kind of split in the population, in elite constituencies? What has produced this intense partisan fighting?
Yeah, well, it's a variety of things. It's not any one thing. As I said, there's still, believe it or not, hard feelings that go back to the impeachment days of Nixon, which, remember, was back in the 70s, 40 years ago. But it's more than that now. It's obviously the change in communications. It's the ability of bloggers and tweeters and everybody else to communicate. It's the change in communications with a growth of something like Fox News, which never existed before. Cable television has changed that rather substantially. It's the change in the Supreme Court's decision that changed the ability of independent groups to spend ridiculous amounts of money, unprecedented amounts of money, to influence an election in ways that we've never seen before, and that seriously undermines the ability of political parties to have an impact on what's going on. And finally, you've got this tremendous growth in independent voters. Something that didn't exist when I was working up on Capitol Hill and running congressional campaigns. About 40% of the United States now thinks of American voters classify themselves as independents, that is, not part of one party or another. And so you've got the ability to make tremendous shifts in the way elections turn out with this group of people right in the middle. So in 2008, we had a wave election where all the independents voted with Obama and the Democrats. In 2010, it worked towards the Republicans' advantage. And truth is, we don't know what's going to happen in 2012. It's hard to see, you know, to use the past as an indication of what the future might be here because of all these factors.
I'm speaking with Stan Collender, who's a longtime D.C. budget watcher and partner in Corvus Communications. Aside from all the automatic cuts and tax increases, we're also facing another debt increase melodrama, right?
An increase in the debt ceiling, obviously. Every time you spend more money or every time you have a budget with a deficit, the government's debt ceiling has to be raised. So the decision to borrow is actually it was made when the spending bills were passed or the revenue cuts were enacted. We're the only country in the world that doesn't automatically increase its borrowing limit to accommodate those things, that it requires a separate vote and a separate law. So that will have to happen. Probably we're going to reach the existing debt limit somewhere in November, maybe December, depending upon how the revenues coming into the government, which means somewhere in early January, maybe February, the government's going to bump into the debt ceiling and have the same kind of problem it had back in August. You've already heard John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, say that he's not going to raise it unless he gets spending cuts, substantial spending cuts, and that's already got the financial markets worried. Interest rates are likely to be higher than they would otherwise be. It's not a good situation. It was bad last August. It'll be even worse if it happens again this time.
And you're no fan of John Boehner, right?
No, I did a column. I have a weekly column in Roll Call, the Capitol Hill newspaper, in which when Boehner got up and said absolutely no increase in the debt ceiling, I did a column and said the title was called The Irresponsibility of John Boehner. I've done a subsequent blog post on my blog, Capital Gains and Games, where I called him an economic saboteur. I think he's the weakest speaker we've seen and maybe the most irresponsible in my lifetime.
What's motivating him?
Re-election as Speaker. He has a real problem. That is, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party and of his own caucus doesn't trust him. I've heard them. They've told me that directly. So Boehner got up there and had to seem holier than thou. That is, to show the Tea Party folks that he was with them, that he was the guy they wanted to re-elect as Speaker, because there is already some wind, some indication that there could be a Tea Party challenge to Boehner as Speaker, and he's just trying to ward that off. We'll see if that's ultimately successful. If the Republicans lose control of the House, which is possible but not likely, or if they lose, let's say, 10 seats, which is now the lowest likely scenario, Boehner's speakership could be in definite trouble.
Now, what about the Tea Party? Who do they represent? Were there like 80 or 90 of them, right?
Well, there are 87 freshman Republicans. I'm not sure all of them would say they were Tea Party folks deep down, but let's say there are 40 to 60 House Republicans and maybe 10 members of the Senate who are avid Tea Party folks. Who do they represent? It's not clear. The average Tea Party person, according to research in polls, is over 65, white, probably been in small business as opposed to big business, and middle class. They mostly get Medicare, and in spite of the fact that they want spending cut, they don't want defense cut, and they don't want Medicare cut. In fact, it's not even clear they identify Medicare as a government program. More than not, they tend to be economically unsure of themselves, I guess is a nice way to say that they don't really know much about economics. They just know that they're not doing that well, and it's a very personally driven thing. So, we've seen groups like this in the past in American history. When unemployment's high and they're worried about losing their jobs, or their checks aren't going as far, or the economic world is not treating them as they want, they tend to come down on the party in power at the moment, and that tends to be the Democrats right now. My guess is that as the economy gets better, assuming it does, the Tea Party will fade from view. But it's at the moment it's an unorganized element of the political Republican Party that has the ability to spend a lot of money on elections and therefore to have some impact on how their members vote and what they say.
Now the traditional corporate base of the Republican Party, Wall Street, Fortune 500 types, certainly cannot be pleased to see these games of fiscal chicken and fiscal suicide. Are they completely marginalized by this gang of bomb throwers?
No, and it's not completely marginalized, but they also don't want to take on some of these folks. I mean, also, Wall Street is a little whipsawed here. On the one hand, they don't like some of the regulatory things that the Democrats have pushed and that Obama is pushing forward with, the Obama administration is pushing forward with, and so that we've seen a lot of drop in support from financial support from Wall Street for Democrats and for the Obama administration. On the other hand, they've got to be as alarmed at some of the things that are going on here in the fiscal cliff and the fact that GDP could end up falling, according to the Congressional Budget Office, by 4% if all of these fiscal cliff policies go into effect. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office put out a report last week that used a word you seldom see in federal published documents. They used the word recession. That is, if the fiscal cliff isn't changed and isn't avoided, if all the policies go into effect and taxes are increased and spending is cut, there'll be a recession in the first two quarters of next year. You've got to believe that whether it's a retailer or a financial institution, they've got to be saying, this is not what we want. And, I guess their hope is maybe they can get their guy in place and then have some of the fiscal cliff policies changed early next year if it starts on January 1.
And just to make it clear to the civilian radio audience, overnight, tightening and fiscal policy of 4% of GDP is massive and shocking, isn't it?
Well, especially when the economy is only growing by 2%, and now you suddenly reducing GDP by 4% means you throw the economy into a tailspin. Again, we talked about this earlier. If the federal government is the only one providing any kind of economic stimulus and it suddenly withdraws that stimulus, it can't possibly be good. That would be 4% would be a huge amount. But it happened very, very quickly. It'd be a huge amount under any circumstances.
So what are the prospects for a dysfunctional body like Congress getting together after the election, but presumably before the inauguration, and actually doing something about all this?
Almost zero. I wish I could tell you it was different. But there are several things. First of all, lame duck sessions are terrible times to be doing economic policy, or any kind of policy for that matter. You've got not a whole lot of time. You've got many members of Congress who aren't returning the next year and really care less about voting than they did before. And they're concerned about finding a job, moving their families. They don't have an office because they have to vacate the offices they were in. They don't have staff who is also out looking for jobs. And unless there's a consensus about what to do, the idea that you're going to make major policy changes in a lame duck session is a little ludicrous. I mean, it's just very unlikely that they're all going to sit down in a kumbaya moment, join hands and say, okay, let's deal with all of these things that we haven't been able to or wanting to deal with the last couple of years. So I think that's relatively small. The most likely outcome instead is a kind of kick the can approach where they extend the tax cuts, fund the government for another year, extend the debt ceiling so that they can pay for all of these things, and postpone, delay, or cancel that automatic across-the-board cut on January 2nd that we were talking about. So in other words, they just put all this off for another year and let the next Congress and the next president deal with it.
And you think that's likely to happen, or how likely is a total disaster?
Ultimately, maybe there's a little wishful thinking on my part, but ultimately I think that rational, calmer minds come together, and somewhere around December 29th or 30th, that is just as we're about to reach this deadline and the train's about to roll over Nell as she's tied to the tracks, I think we will have they will come up with this deal that simply extends everything for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, somewhere in there. Honestly, it won't be a very fun new year for anybody if they don't get this done.
And presumably a short extension of the debt ceiling?
The best possible outcome would be extending the debt ceiling for a year. That is, if they extend the tax cuts and delay the spending cuts, and therefore the government has to borrow more because the deficit is higher, the best possible outcome would be an increase in the debt ceiling to accommodate that whole amount. I think the more likely outcome, though, quite honestly, Doug, is that we're going to get a replay of 2011 with a series of short-term extensions and a series of perils of Pauline cliffhanger endings where markets are you know, reacting to the disruptions and the uncertainty kind of on a perpetual basis.
Though, of course, if there's a Republican president, the motive of sabotage would be removed.
Well, except that, even with a Romney as president, and even if the Republicans win control of the Senate, the majorities in both houses will be smaller. That is, Republicans are likely to have a smaller majority in the House and a small majority in the Senate, a smaller majority in the Senate than the Democrats have now. I think from what I've been told and the analysts I talked to, the best Republicans will do in the Senate is a 51-49 majority. The Democrats currently have 53-47. If that's the case, if it's 51-49, then first of all, any one Republican who's out sick or traveling or whatever changes the balance pretty substantially to 50-50, where the vice president would vote to break the tie. More important, though, the Democrats are likely to use the same kind of delay tactics that the Republicans did and require that they get 60 votes for everything and anything that they want to do. So sabotage could go both ways under those circumstances.
What a way to run a government, huh?
It's not a way to run a railroad and certainly not a way to run a government.
That was Stan Collender, the veteran D.C. budget watcher. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with a bit of My Husband's Pied-a-Terre from the new Magnetic Fields album. Till next week, bye.